out on my case, get this, for smiling. Two guys drop 84 points on your ass, George said, and I'm thinking, where's the pissed off competitor? I look at Ray, he's out there smiling. Tell me what that's all about. I'll tell you exactly what that was about. I smiled because I was able to do something I loved for a living, even when it didn't go my way. Shannon was right when I poured my soul out to her on the pier the night of the draft. I was blessed. George even got upset with me for smiling during practice. Once after he caught Sam and me laughing, he quickly pulled me aside. I can't have my best player messing around on the sideline, he said. We're trying to be serious, and the other guys are following you. Frankly, I didn't see anything wrong with playing the game with joy. I don't believe smiling held Magic Johnson back. Besides, if you practice hard, what difference should it make whether you play with anger or not? Anger is not going to help you set a solid screen or throw an accurate pass or box out your man. If anything, anger will take you out of your rhythm. George's suggestion that I care too much about being cool didn't make sense to me either. Whenever I floated in the air and laid the ball in softly off the glass, people would tell me, "Man, that looked so smooth." That's because it wasn't an aggressive move, and it didn't have to be. I never saw the upside in using more energy than you needed to. Make the other guy spend it. Come the fourth quarter, you'll have the fresher legs. He was also hard on me in front of my teammates. At least I knew it was coming. There are going to be times where I got to get on you to use you as an example so I can get on the other guys, George said. They'll see that I am not playing favorites. You're going to have to roll with it. Which I did, over and over. But getting on me in public as he did in the Sports Illustrated interview was entirely different. That I would most certainly not roll with. Another warning sign was when I called Terry Stotts, one of our assistant coaches, in the summer of 2001 to see if he wanted to join me for a round of golf at the country club I belonged to. Terry and I teed it up as often as we could. George said I can't play golf with you, he said. He told you what? How my playing golf with Terry had anything to do with the fortunes of the Milwaukee Bucks was beyond me. Terry was doing what he was told. With George, you were either with him or against him. And the other coaches couldn't afford to be against him. So when did everything we built over 3 years begin to unravel? When we signed Anthony Mason. I was excited when we picked up Anthony, a free agent, a week before the start of the 2001-02 season. The one ingredient we lacked was toughness, and Anthony would give us that, as he gave it to the Knicks as a power forward in the mid-1990s, when they almost won the championship, and to the Heat, where he was an all-star in 2001. Plus, Anthony, may he rest in peace, wasn't a bad dude. That fall, with him averaging 7.5 rebounds, we took 9 of our first 10. But then we hit the road, and the skids. We lost 5 in a row, 4 by double digits. Although we seemed to turn things around in January, when we won 8 straight, that run was misleading. Our chemistry was rotten under the surface, so it was no surprise when we dropped 27 of the next 40. You can't hide your flaws for long. Not on a stage this big. The problem was Anthony. Instead of searching for ways to fit in as the new guy, he expected everybody else to conform to him. Bill Bradley, the former Knick, put it best in his book, Life on the Run, where he describes the sacrifices required from every player to win a title. A team championship exposes the limits of self-reliance, selfishness, and irresponsibility. One man alone can't make it happen. In fact, the contrary is true. A single man can prevent it from happening. Bradley wrote that in 1976, and as much as basketball has changed, that's one truth about the sport that hasn't. Anthony wanted the ball on almost every possession, and when we did not give it to him, he complained to no end and didn't care who might notice. A lot of times when I took a 3 in transition, He lowered his hands and headed down the court with the worst body language you could imagine, as if I had thrown the ball into Lake Michigan. Our style was playing fast and taking the first good shot we saw. But with him holding on to the ball in the post, for an eternity, it seemed, we went from shooting with 16 or 18 seconds left on the 24-second clock to shooting with 3 or 4 seconds. He disrupted our whole continuity. The huddles were the worst. George would be giving instructions when Anthony, I kid you not, would turn his chair to the side and look into the crowd. He didn't listen to a word George said. I had never seen a player act like that, not even in junior high. He wasn't just disrespecting the coach. He was disrespecting the game and his teammates. There were times Sam would go to the baseline to bring the ball up after a made basket, which was his job as point guard, and Anthony would rush down there to beat him to it. Good luck getting the ball out of his hands. You had to assume George, with his need to always be in control, would make sure to keep Anthony in line. Oh, he tried, for a while, but Anthony would give it right back to him. You fat motherfucker, shut the fuck up. Normally, when a player doesn't respect the coach, he's benched, and if that doesn't set him straight, he's fined. The last resort is to waive the guy, and it doesn't matter how much money he was making or what holes it would create for the roster. George didn't take any of those steps. He was afraid of Anthony. He let him get away with anything. My teammates and I had nothing to be proud of either. We didn't try to confront Anthony as individuals or as a unit. We tried to please him so he wouldn't be angry with us. Perhaps we were also afraid of him. We should have seen it coming. Others around the league did. After a game against the Heat, one of their guys stopped by to visit us in the locker room. "Why didn't you call me?" said the player, who had been Anthony's teammate for several years and was familiar with his antics. "I would have told you." "Thanks a lot," I said. "Now you tell me." Actually, this player wasn't the first. One day in training camp before we signed Anthony, Irvin Johnson, our center, gave me a call. "Ray, be careful what you wish for," Irvin said. "He wants that ball, and he can destroy everything that's going on." I went to our general manager, Ernie Grunfeld, to see if he could solve the problem. Ernie reached out to a few teams, but nobody wanted Anthony. "You have to assume this is what we're going to have for the rest of the year," he told me. We would also have George, who didn't know how to avoid controversy. I'm no psychologist, but it was almost as if he went looking for it. Take the comments he made in an interview with Esquire, which hit the newsstands in March of that season. The reporter asked about Doc Rivers, who was coaching the Orlando Magic. Easy enough. Just say a few kind words and go on to the next question. Except nothing was easy for George. He said Doc, who went directly from the TV booth to the Orlando job, hadn't paid his dues as an assistant coach in the NBA, that he had been anointed, and that it would result in 4 or 5 more anointments of the young Afro-American coach. What George said was racist, and there was no getting around it. What about Larry Bird? He had not been an assistant coach either, before he was hired by the Pacers in 1997. George didn't bring his name up. By the way, Doc played in the league for 13 years. Don't tell me that's not paying your dues. My teammates and I didn't confront George as we didn't confront Anthony. We talked to the media when we should have talked to him. Between Anthony and George, you can see how distracted we were, and ultimately why the losses piled up. Still, heading into the final game of the regular season, a win over the Pistons in Detroit would put us in the playoffs and then, who knows? We certainly had the talent to make a nice run. Some players embraced the challenge, like Darvin Ham, who entered the locker room wearing his military fatigues. Some didn't, including me. I told Shannon I didn't want to make the playoffs. It sounds awful, I know, but let me explain. Making the playoffs, in my opinion, would have made everything that went wrong that season okay, and it was anything but okay. It was despicable, and I was sure the same squabbles would sabotage us again. this time before a national audience. I wanted no part of that. There was nothing to worry about. The Pistons led by 20 at the half and didn't look back. The final, 123-89. I scored 6 points in 23 minutes. From nearly reaching the finals to being in the draft lottery with the other losers, ladies and gentlemen, these are your Milwaukee Bucks. And that's life in the NBA. No guarantees from one year to the next. Now what? If no one wanted Anthony, who would go? Somebody had to. You don't fall apart as fast as we did and stand pat. Not if you're George or Ernie and you hope to keep your own job. In August, we got the answer. Glenn Robinson. The Bucks sent Glenn to the Hawks for Tony Kukoc, Leon Smith, and a first-round draft choice in 2003. Good move, I thought. Tim Thomas could definitely fill his place. I actually felt he had the potential to be the best player in the league. Besides being a tremendous shooter, Tim could handle the ball and was extremely athletic. He was 6'10" and could play every position on the floor, including point guard. If only I had kept my opinions to myself. Instead, at camp that fall, I criticized Glenn for how he dealt with an ankle injury, and when he found out, he left me a nasty message through a friend of mine. I didn't blame him. Glenn and I won a lot of games together, and he was one of the best I ever played with. That's what I should have told the reporters. Later on, when I experienced my own ankle problems, I felt even worse. I understood pain in a way I never had before. Glenn was not the only one to go. George also fired a few of the assistant coaches, including Terry Stotts, who had been with him for many years. No way did Terry deserve it, and we suspected it was only because George was afraid the senator would ask him to take over if the team continued to struggle. Terry did a good job on the occasions he filled in for George. He was composed on the sidelines. Imagine that, which helped us compete with a looseness you didn't see otherwise. But parting with Glenn and the coaches didn't turn things around. We won a few, then lost a few, never showing signs of the team that made it to the Eastern Conference Finals only 2 seasons before. By the end of January, we were barely over 500, and as you might guess, my relationship with George became more tenuous than ever. He was now questioning how tough I was. When our trainer told me not to practice one day because of the tendonitis in my knee, George saw his opening. "George isn't happy with you," the reporter said. "I don't know what you're talking about," I replied. Soon enough, I found out. George, without saying a word to me first, nothing unusual there, had got on my case for not practicing, with no mention of what the trainer advised. You can find fault with me, but not with my willingness to practice or to play in pain. When I got to the NBA in 1996, my goal was to be like Cal Ripken, the Hall of Fame infielder for the Baltimore Orioles, who didn't miss a game for more than 16 years. I wasn't sure how good I'd become, but I'd show up every day. Fortunately, I was able to avoid serious injuries and do just that. Not until my 6th season, after appearing in 400 straight games, did I miss my first. I was sitting on the training table before our game against the Houston Rockets in December 2001 when the tendonitis flared up again. I jumped up and down. I practically sprinted in the hallway. I tried everything I could think of to get loose to no avail. My leg was too sore. I felt awful for the people who had come to see me for the first time. In any case, I allowed George to get to me. And that was my fault, not his. From then on, whenever I twisted my ankle in a game or in practice, I forced myself back on the court regardless of how severely it was hurting. I refused to let anyone think for one second that George was right about me. Yet, no matter what I did, he found a way to make me wrong. I was with several executives at Nike headquarters in Portland one day, checking out the latest sneakers, when we bumped into him. "Hey, how's it going, George?" they said. There was no hello or warm response of any kind. "Why are you hanging around with this guy?" he said. You should have seen the high school play he made last night. George walked away and did not say another word. Keep in mind, I had scored 35 that same evening against the Clippers on 14 of 19 from the field in a game we won, 104-85. George didn't bring that up. No. Instead, he felt the need to put me down in front of others. He never displayed the slightest emotion whenever we went on a big run and the other team had to call a timeout. Other coaches clap or pump their fist whenever that happens. Not him. The joint would be going nuts, and he would stand there as if we were down 20 points instead of up 20. Later in my career, with Nate McMillan or Bob Hill or Doc Rivers, I found it odd to be with coaches who cheered us on. I hadn't seen that kind of passion on the bench since Coach Calhoun. George once told me, "Sometimes, Ray, you just need to be a dumb basketball player." Translation: do what I tell you to do and stop asking so many damn questions. I could never figure out why George would say something like that. I would think that, if anything, a coach would want to seek out smart players who ask a lot of questions. Asking questions, it stands to reason, would make you more prepared for any surprises on the court. Years later, I heard from players in Denver what George supposedly told Carmelo Anthony, whom he also didn't get along with. "Carmelo, you're a dumb basketball player." I know Carmelo, and that couldn't be further from the truth. I have no idea why George disliked me so much. It wasn't that way in the beginning. He lived down the street, and we used to play volleyball in the backyard and have meals together. He invited me to a golf tournament he organized in Boise. Maybe he was envious of the relationship I had with the senator, or maybe he felt I had more power than he did. Another theory is that he wasn't fond of stars. Except for Gary Payton, whom he coached in Seattle and, later, Milwaukee, I can't recall a high-profile player on one of George's teams he did get along with. George once complained to me about his teammate from the 1970s, George Gervin, a.k.a. the Iceman. Gervin, one of the most explosive scorers the game has ever seen, would take the shot even if he was doubled and the other George was wide open. And with good reason. In his career, mostly with the Spurs, the Iceman shot over 50%. George, though, never forgave Gervin for not passing the ball to him, and I really believe he took his resentment out on other stars. The less regarded players, on the other hand, he'd rave about, such as Mark Pope, our seldom used forward. That was because George had been one of them. "He's our best player in practice," he'd tell us. "All you guys need to be like Mark." If George was so in love with Mark, the rest of us wondered, why the hell wasn't he starting him every night? Whatever it was that pitted him against me, I didn't realize how dire the situation truly was until I spoke to Sam Mitchell, an assistant coach who joined the Bucks in 2002. I was working out on the first floor at the practice facility when Sam, whose office was on the second floor, saw me and hurried down. "Don't trust none of those motherfuckers up there," Sam told me. "I was in a meeting, and every one of them was ripping you. They sat there and tried to convince me you're a problem." "Problem?" I told them. "I don't see how he's a problem. He's here every day working on his game." If Sam could see how dedicated I was, I have to believe the other coaches could see it as well. And if they did, how come they did not tell George he was wrong about me? Again, you're either with him or against him. I received a similar warning from Darvin Ham. "I need to talk to you," he told me one day when I walked into the locker room. "There are a lot of cats in here saying you're not doing this or you're not doing that. I want you to know I see the work you put in." The locker room is like high school sometimes, with the cliques that form and the gossip, much of it untrue, that somebody spreads. I appreciated that Darvin had the courage to tell me what he'd heard. Running out of patience, I went to see the senator. If anybody could resolve the issues between George and myself, it was him. His advice was simple. Talk to the man. My response was also simple. Too late. Every time I did, George tried to convince me I was angry with Sam or Anthony or Tim. Anybody but him. Senator Cole, in any case, was not about to tell George what to do. Most owners hand over power to the coaches, until the day they let him go. I felt I had no choice but to tell the senator that perhaps it would be best for everyone if I were to move on. I wasn't, after all, the type of person to issue an ultimatum. Not that it would have made any difference. If I could do it over again, I would have reached out to George one final time. "My job is to help you win," I would have said. "And if you have complaints, come to me instead of the media. I don't appreciate the attacks on my character, and neither does my family." Why didn't I? Because growing up as the son of a man in the armed forces, I learned you don't talk back to authority figures. You follow orders. Only years later did I realize that authority figures sometimes make terrible choices like the rest of us, and when they do, you need to resist and hope the people above them listen to what you have to say. I would have also looked for more support from my teammates. Others, I'm sure, felt the way Darvin did. If we stuck together, we could have forced George to stop playing us off against one another. As I knew from my days at UConn, a team that acts as one is something to behold. Several weeks after my chat with the senator, the team went on the road. There were 30 games to go. Anything could still happen. Anything indeed. I was stretching on the court at the arena in Seattle the day before a game with the Sonics when, every time I turned my back, the cameramen in the tunnel shined their lights on me. I had never seen so many cameras at a practice. "What's going on?" I asked them. "There's been a trade," they said. "Who got traded?" They pointed at me. "Say what?" I went over to gather more information, and as I did, I noticed George walking off the floor at the other end of the court, as if trying to escape. He had known the whole day this deal was in the works, yet he hadn't said a word to me, either on the bus ride from the hotel or once we arrived at the arena. The Bucks were acquiring Gary Payton, one of the premier guards in the game, and swingman Desmond Mason. George told the senator that Michael Redd, my backup, could do everything I could. The senator believed him. I was shocked. All the speculation leading up to the trade deadline was that Tim Thomas, nearing the end of his contract, was the one on the block, not me. Reporters even asked me what I thought Tim must be going through. Traded or not, I said, he would still get paid. It wasn't as if he'd be sent to prison. Everything happened quickly from that point on. I went back to the hotel with Kevin Ollie, my buddy from Connecticut, who was also going to the Sonics. An hour or so later, Nate McMillan, the Seattle coach, picked KO and me up and drove us to meet Howard Schultz, the owner and then CEO of Starbucks, at his house. House? The place was more like a mountain. You didn't know where it began and where it ended. Mr. Schultz offered us some coffee. Of course he did. He told us he had a 5-year plan to win a championship, and the Sonics were currently in year 2. I loved what he was saying in one sense. You always want to play for an owner who reaches for the stars. In another, though, I found it almost laughable. You can't put a timetable on winning the title. There are too many unknowns. My emotions were all over the place. I was relieved to be getting away from such a toxic environment where I had to look over my shoulder every 5 seconds to find out what George might be saying about me to the media. On the other hand, I'd grown quite fond of Milwaukee. I'd put everything I had into the franchise, and we had begun to build something special until the very next season. It fell apart. We could have won a title. Maybe 2. Likewise, George should have been given his due for being an excellent teacher and strategist. He could have created a dynasty wherever he coached, if he hadn't gotten in his own way. More than anything, I was upset with how the trade went down. If George didn't have the guts to give me a heads up, Ernie or the senator should have done it. A player should never receive news like that from the media. By the way, I didn't speak to George before I left. and haven't spoken to him since. The afternoon of the trade, before K.O. and I went to meet Mr. Schultz, I was riding up in the escalator at the hotel while George was riding down. He couldn't make eye contact. That's when I knew it was him who got rid of me. The deal, if I can be objective for a moment, was a disaster for the Bucks. Peyton, a free agent, signed with the Lakers after appearing in just 28 games for the team, which was knocked out in the first round of the playoffs by the New Jersey Nets. The players I spoke to around the league couldn't figure out what the Bucks were thinking. "That's bullshit," Shaq told me before my debut as a Sonic in Los Angeles. It didn't improve my mood any when, the following night, during my first game at Key Arena, the fans who worshipped Peyton held up signs to show how they felt about the deal. One sign read, "February 20th, 2003, the day the Sonics died." Ouch. I was booed when the trade was announced in Milwaukee in 1996, and now there I was again, landing in a city where fans preferred someone else. The only way to respond was to work as hard as usual, if not harder. I won them over the first time. There was no guarantee I would win them over again. 10. Soaring in Seattle. Once I recovered from the initial shock, I looked forward to starting over in a different part of the country. Moving around, as you know, was nothing new for me. What was new was the role of leader I was expected to take on. It was my time. That hadn't been the case in Milwaukee. Think about it. What veteran would take any advice from some punk in his early 20s? What could he possibly know that they didn't? So, for the most part, I kept my mouth shut. Besides, Sam Cassell did enough talking for the rest of us. It was more than my youth, to be honest, that had prevented me from seizing a more prominent role. Even when I was the best player on the team, in high school or college, I wasn't very vocal. Nor did it change much after I was in He Got Game. The guard I took down to be Jesus Shuttlesworth, except with close friends and family, went back up when I became Ray Allen again. I would try to set an example on the court and in the locker room, but I wouldn't hover over guys trying to get them to do their jobs. When I arrived in Seattle, no one had to tell me what to do. I could see for myself the team needed a leader now that Gary was gone. You've traded away an obvious Hall of Famer. You better get a leader in return. Understandably, though, the player seemed a little nervous about the type of leader I might be. Knowing what Gary was like, he and I had our disagreements at the 2000 Olympics. I had a clear sense of where they were coming from. Would I be as demanding? And is that how every franchise player acts? It sure is, if winning is your ultimate goal. Gary, in fact, was one of the toughest competitors I faced. During my 18 years in the NBA, I can't think of anyone who played a more in-your-face defense than he did. And he was no slouch on the offensive end, either. You could count on him for about 20 points and 10 assists a night. He played with a great deal of intensity night after night, and was never afraid to take risks, which is probably why he and George got along so well. I found out more about Gary by watching the tape of a game from earlier in the season. A player on the team the Sonics were facing made a nifty move to get open. And suddenly, here comes Gary, running from the other side of the court to double the guy. And I mean running. I couldn't recall seeing a player make a switch like that. "What kind of defense do you guys call this?" I asked one of the players. "Dude," he said laughing, "we don't call that anything. He just made stuff up as he went along." I would never be that daring. I believed in systems, for better or worse, from my by-the-book upbringing. I don't like surprises, especially on defense. Your teammates should have a good idea of where you'll be rotating from in any given set. If anything, Gary may have been too capable. Other guys were not able to blossom because, between the way he played and the sheer force of his personality, there was little room left. "But in order for us to be successful," I told the team, "it will take everyone to contribute at both ends. I need you to get rebounds, to give us second chance opportunities to do the little things to win games. In adjusting to the new role, there was a voice in my head. It belonged to George Carl. I know, it sounds like I must have been haunted, but I wasn't. Weirdly enough, it was a voice of reason. Despite the problems we had, George taught me more about basketball than I could begin to remember. I wouldn't have been the player I was without him. So, in Seattle, I found a way to bring out the good George and leave the bad one behind. Like when he got on me for joking with Sam in practice, I felt he was overreacting at the time. But as I gave the issue more thought, I saw his point. If I were to fool around too much, guys might get the wrong impression. And as a leader now, with people watching my every move, even in practice, I didn't want them to think I didn't take my job seriously. We knew how to have some fun, too. On our long plane rides, Seattle felt like it was on another planet, not just a different time zone. Five of us used to play a card game called Bure, similar to spades, the idea being to take the most tricks in each hand. The pot typically started at $100, and it could go awfully high before you knew where your money went. Winning or losing thousands of dollars on one flight wasn't uncommon. Once, years later, when I was with the Celtics, the security police at the Toronto airport were taking out the lotion I'd mistakenly left in my bag when it hit me what else I'd left there. $35,000 in cash. Back then, players, yours truly included, routinely carried a lot of cash during road trips, till it dawned on us we'd be better off using credit cards. The police found the cash and, because I hadn't declared it, were about to keep it. I was detained in some office for an hour, maybe longer, while my teammates on the plane were left wondering what happened to me. I hadn't been detained like that since I stole the box of licorice at Edwards. By the way, they allowed me to keep the cash. From George, I learned how to let the game come to me, not the other way around. There's a big difference. In my first 2 years under Coach Ford, if I didn't touch the ball for 5 or 6 possessions, I wasn't very patient when it did come to me. That's usually when you make mistakes. George set me straight. Never attempt a difficult shot during the first and second quarters. Get other players involved in the offense. Then, if you need a bucket in the third quarter, and definitely in the fourth, feel free to take control. The guys in Seattle realized what I was up to, so whenever I drew a double team and got them the ball where they wanted it, everybody prefers a different spot. They were ready to make a play for themselves or for a teammate. From the start, I encouraged them to be more accountable to one another. That's the coach's job, needless to say, and in no way was I trying to take it away from Nate, who was more than competent in that regard. It's just that, as a player, you get tired of listening to the same voice, especially if that person is constantly telling you what you did wrong. It doesn't matter if the coach is Greg Popovich or Phil Jackson or Steve Kerr. Every voice gets old, which is when you, if you are the leader you claim to be, have to step up. The guys need to hear a different voice. Say, for example, someone isn't working hard enough on his defense. You may think you're hurting the coach, you tell him, but you are really hurting your teammates. It wasn't long before I saw steady improvement on and off the court. A perfect example was Jerome James, our talented 7-foot-1 center. Too often, Jerome didn't show up at practice or games as early as he could have, but he always had an excuse, some more original than others. Once, and I swear this is true, he said he had to stop to help an old lady cross the street. "If you had come in earlier," I replied, without missing a beat, "you never would have seen the old lady cross the street." Jerome also used to wear sweatsuits on his way to the locker room before games. Hoping not to sound like a camp counselor, I gave him a little advice. "How do you think people feel when they see you come dressed like that?" I asked. "Do they think you're ready to play your best? If you show people you're serious about your job, it will change how they view you, and it will change how you play." To his credit, he learned from his mistakes. And so did another player, Rashard Lewis. Though in his 5th season when I joined the Sonics, He was still only 23 and hadn't come close to reaching his potential. I knew he would get there because Rashard possessed something you can't teach. Desire. I saw my share of players who could have been marked with the P for potential that Coach Dickerman from Connecticut once put next to my name, but who didn't have the desire and never were what they should have been. I want to make the money you make, Rashard once said to me. Good for you, I told him. I've always believed if you have a goal, don't keep it in your head. Put it out to the universe. Write it on a wall or in your phone or on a notebook, somewhere you can look at it, so it's no longer a secret you're protecting. Maybe from others, but mostly from yourself. You protect it out of fear, thinking if you don't achieve your goal, you will never have to admit to yourself or to anyone else that you failed. Some say it isn't wise to put it out to the universe, that it only puts the pressure on yourself. I say, precisely. There's nothing wrong, by the way, with having the goal, as Rashard did, of earning as much money as possible. Athletes, remember, have a small window for success that closes fast, which is why I empathized with Latrell Sprewell, the controversial all-star guard from the 1990s who was crucified for saying he had a family to feed, to explain why he was rejecting a contract extension worth $21 million. Get as much as you can. That's always been my attitude. For anybody who thinks that sounds greedy, I've got news for you. The owner signing the paychecks make more than the players. A lot more. Rashard came in every day to get his shots up, and within no time he developed into one of the better young players in the league. Put him in the post, you knew he'd get the shot he wanted, and he could hit the three. The payday he wanted would come soon enough. The entire team started to work just as hard. I loved to see the guys grow day by day, and came up with a bunch of shooting games after practice to get us even more prepared to compete. Those shooting games were intense. Coach Calhoun would have been impressed. In one game, around the world, everybody lined up in the corner and had to hit five straight shots before advancing to the next spot, the elbow three. Whoever made it through the final spot at the opposite corner first would be declared the best shooter that day and, better yet, be the only one who would not have to do any running afterward. Pity the player who finished last. He had to do suicides, like we did at UConn, running back and forth between the baselines. Finish second to last, and you would have to run from half court to the back court and back to half court. The pressure you put on yourself to reach the next spot was akin to being in a game, which was the point. You would become so familiar with needing to make a three to stay alive that you wouldn't panic in a similar situation when the games were for real. What mattered more than anything was the trust we came to have in one another, and it resulted from those long road trips. There are only so many card games you can play. We talked for hours and hours about life. The guys asked for my opinion, and I gave it, and if I didn't know something, I said I would get back to them. I became the unofficial liaison between the players and Nate, a role I was happy to assume. Once, after a win in Minnesota, they asked me to reach out to Nate about getting a rare day off. We definitely needed it. Lots of times we didn't arrive home until 4 or 5 in the morning, and yet we still needed to show up for practice at 12:30. Even so, it would require all my powers of persuasion to convince Nate to agree. That's not how he is wired. When he played for the Sonics in the 80s and 90s, guys routinely went through two-a-days. They don't need a day off, he told me. They're 22 years old. To set the practice schedule was his right. He was the coach, and I was a player who should have kept his mouth shut. It almost seems like Nate forgot what it was like to be a player, I told a reporter. I was joking when I said it, but that wasn't how it came out in the paper. Nate brought a copy to practice the next day and took me aside. You're killing me for this, he said. I apologized right away. I felt awful. Call it another wake-up call. I require quite a few, it would appear, to remind myself how careful I had to be whenever there was a writer hanging around. Being the face of the franchise, I would make news with almost anything I said. Look, I don't begrudge these guys for trying to get a scoop. Only they'd have to get a scoop without any help from me. At 22 and 30, the Sonics were going nowhere when I came aboard, trailing the better teams, Dallas, San Antonio, Sacramento, Portland, Minnesota, Utah, and the West by a large margin. But after my debut, a 106-101 loss to the Lakers, we won 5 straight. The playoffs weren't out of the question, except we couldn't win more than 3 games in a row the rest of the way, ending up 40-42. 4 games behind the Phoenix Suns, the number 8 seed. No matter, the future was bright. Besides Richard and Jerome, Vladimir Ratmanovic, a forward from Serbia, was also showing a lot of promise. Vlad had an amazing arc on his jump shots. If only I had felt better about what was taking place away from the court. There was the issue of food in our locker room, which was not provided unless we asked for it. By contrast, the Mavericks' Mark Cuban not only made sure his team's locker room was well-stocked, he also took care of the visiting team. Now that's the kind of owner you want to play for. Another point of contention was the luggage. Every team provided each player with 2 pieces, complete with the team's logo and their name. Every team, that is, except ours. The owners felt we could pay for our own luggage. They got us the bags eventually, but they wouldn't put our names or numbers on them, saying they would be stolen on the curb. Nonsense. I never heard of any team having its bags ripped off. All this complaining about food and luggage might seem trivial, but it's not. Our job was to play the game to the best of our abilities, so anything the organization took care of meant there was one less detail we had to be concerned with. I'm not suggesting these issues kept players from giving a total effort, but I will say this. I have never seen a guy who was treated well by an organization not show his appreciation in a way that benefits the team. Players around the league share information with one another as owners do. We know which teams watch over their players and which don't. At first, I kept quiet, as I did in Milwaukee. But as a leader, I couldn't avoid speaking up forever. In the spring of 2004, a reporter asked me how the Sonics conducted business compared to the Bucks. I said the Sonics could do a better job, especially if it hoped to entice the top free agents. I don't recall the article word by word, but I'll never forget the headline in the Seattle paper. Allen wants better amenities. I came across like a spoiled diva instead of somebody addressing real concerns. Even Mr. Schultz took exception. He called to say that I was being disingenuous and offered to give me a tutorial on what it took to run an NBA franchise. No, thank you. I did not need a tutorial to know you can't run a team the way you run Starbucks. This isn't the corporate world. Most owners do not make any real money until they sell the team. In the meantime, you spend what it takes to upgrade the roster and coaching staff, and yes, to provide food in the locker room and luggage for road trips. I said what I had to say, and didn't regret it for a second. That would not be the situation, unfortunately, a few months later on, when it came to comments I made about Kobe Bryant. I'd regret those comments for some time. So much for those earlier wake-up calls. I was in the locker room in Portland before an exhibition game against the Blazers in October, when the press asked me about our opponent the night before, the Lakers, who had traded Shaq to the Heat in the offseason. I said that I couldn't figure out why Kobe got rid of him, and that every other shooting guard in the league would give anything to play with a center that dominant. That wasn't all. I said that, in a year or two, Kobe was going to regret the deal and ask for ownership to acquire more players or to be traded himself because his team wouldn't be any good. What I said doesn't seem that horrible, really. But as I wasn't a member of the Lakers or privy to what took place behind the scenes, it was not my business to weigh in on his situation. My attention should have been only on the team I played for. I certainly would have been upset if a player from another organization got involved in our affairs. Shortly afterward, someone I knew called me out of the locker room before a preseason game against the Lakers in San Diego. "I just want to give you the heads up," the guy warned, "because this dude, Kobe, told the big man to give you a hard foul in the game tonight. I want to tell you because you're my man. Be careful out there." Was I shocked? Not in the least. Nor was I angry, although I did feel it was a little cowardly of him. He could have spoken directly to me instead of sending somebody to do his dirty work. We might have gotten past it. I didn't play that night, by the way, because of a sore ankle. The media tried to keep the controversy going as long as possible, though it died down eventually, replaced by another, no doubt. In any case, I vowed I would not make the same mistake again. And I didn't. 3 years later, I was in L.A., of all places, playing in a golf tournament, when the story broke that Kobe was asking for a trade, as I predicted. Each time I walked near the clubhouse, a reporter approached for a comment. I declined. Then, in 2011, during the All-Star Game weekend in Los Angeles, I apologized to Kobe. I could tell he appreciated the sentiment. In the fall of 2004, we couldn't wait to make up for the season before, when we finished 37-45 and did not come close to making the playoffs. It didn't help I missed the first 25 games after injuring an ankle in the preseason. This year will be different, we told ourselves. In addition to Rashard, Vlad, Jerome, and me, we had more than capable veterans such as Antonio Daniels, Brent Barry, Vitaly Potapenko, and Danny Fortson. Meanwhile, we were counting on Luke Ridenour, a second-year point guard from Oregon, and Nick Collison, a rookie forward from Kansas, to step up. So what happened on opening night in L.A.? We lost by 30. To the Clippers. Someone by the name of Bobby Simmons made 13 of his 15 shots. Fortunately, it wasn't a sign of things to come. In fact, we went in the opposite direction, taking our next 9 and 17 of 19. We were playing at a fast tempo, taking the first good shot available, similar to the Milwaukee teams I'd been on. Even so, because we weren't on TV much, people in the rest of the country did not take us seriously. That began to change in December after we beat the mighty Spurs on the road. There was no place more difficult to win than in San Antonio. "The Sonics are for real," a top national columnist wrote. We were indeed. Going into the last 3.5 weeks of the season, our record was 48-20. Yet I didn't get too carried away. You have to keep the focus always on getting better. Besides, there were more concerns off the court. Prior to the season, with as many as 9 players in the final year of their contract, ownership said they would take care of us if we did our job, but there was reason to believe they didn't mean it. Case in point, Damian Wilkins. Damian, the nephew of NBA Hall of Famer Dominique Wilkins, was a rookie guard for us in 2004. He wasn't drafted, but he worked his butt off in training camp to make the roster and was a key part of our success, which was why we were taken aback when he told us he heard from his agent the organization was thinking about cutting him. "It doesn't make any sense," I told him. "I'll go talk to management." Our GM, Rick Sund, agreed. Damian wasn't going anywhere. Clearly, the agent had gotten his information from someone close to the ownership group. Sund, on this occasion at least, got his way. Nonetheless, the others remained on edge about where they would wind up after the season ended, so as a leader, I felt it was time again to speak up. "Guys," I assured them, "let's take care of business, and we'll get our just dues, and if they don't want to pay us, someone else will." The message got through. Everybody put any anxieties aside, and that was because we had faith in one another. It helped that, as a free agent myself after the season, I would be in the same position as many of them. Yet we won only 4 of our final 14 to end up 52-30. That's not exactly the kind of momentum you look for heading into the playoffs. Fortunately, We regrouped to knock off the Sacramento Kings in 5 games in the first round to set up a battle with the Spurs, who were gunning for their 3rd title in 7 years. Forget about Tim Duncan and Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili, as gifted as they were. My mind was on Bruce Bowen. No one guarded me like Bowen did, and I don't mean that as a compliment. He kicked me when I was on the floor, walked underneath me when I shot the ball, and elbowed me in the stomach. He did everything but tackle me in front of the Alamo. A teammate of mine could drive down the lane uncontested, and Bowen would not move an inch to try to stop him. In the game he was in, there were only 2 men on the floor, him and me, and his job was to stay glued to my hip. I was being tested, as I was on the playground in South Carolina, and if I allowed Bowen and his Bush League tactics to get to me, we wouldn't stand a chance. What concerned me even more than Bruce Bowen was the fear I saw in a few of my younger teammates, fear that they didn't belong on the same stage with a group as used to winning as the Spurs. The pressure is on them, I told the guys. Everyone expects them to win. No one expects us to. Sure enough, the Spurs won the 1st 2 games in San Antonio by 22 and 17 points. They played at their usual high level, although we made it much easier for them with 29 turnovers. You can't give it up like that in the playoffs, especially, where each possession is critical. In Game 3, with the crowd on our side, we regained our composure. We had only 10 turnovers and escaped with a 92-91 win when Duncan missed a 4-footer just before the horn. Phew. Speaking of misses, I was 6-for-23 in that game, and that was on me as much as any tactic Bowen resorted to. Jerome and Antonio played great, thank goodness, Jerome hitting all 7 of his shots, while Antonio scored 18 points and had 8 rebounds. Our defense was outstanding, holding the Spurs without a field goal in the final 4 minutes and 27 seconds. See, guys? I told you. We definitely belong on the same stage with them. In Game 4, it was Luke Ridenour's turn. Luke scored 20 points, 15 during the 3rd quarter, and added 6 assists and 3 steals to lead us to a 101-89 win, despite missing Rashard, who had a sprained toe on his left foot. Damian chipped in with 15, while Antonio had 19 points and 7 assists. The series, heading back to San Antonio, was tied at 2 games apiece. In Game 5, with Rashard still out, along with Vlad, we hung with the Spurs for a half, the score 50-50. But without those two, we were forced to dig deeper into our bench. And that was probably too much to ask from guys with little experience under this kind of pressure, especially on the road. San Antonio went on a 17-3 run to start the 3rd quarter, Ginobili hitting a couple of threes while Bowen stuck to me tighter than ever. I didn't make a shot the entire quarter and missed 3 free throws after hitting 55 of 59 so far in these playoffs. Still, our team had grown up quite a bit over the past week. Let's go home, we told ourselves, hold serve, and come back here to give them a battle in Game 7. Maybe the Spurs would feel the anxiety this time. We'll never know. In Seattle, we lost by 2 when Duncan, on a pass from Ginobili, hit a layup with less than a second left. I was able to get off a jump shot from the corner, but with Duncan all over me, I could barely see the basket. The ball hit the rim, but didn't come close to going in. Game over, season over, everything over. That's how I felt sitting in front of my locker, like it was the final day of summer camp, and everyone was going their separate ways, which hurt more than the loss itself. There is always another game, until of course you hang it up for good. But the bond you form with the men by your side is what you value most, then and forever. Jerome was the first to go. Signed in July by the Knicks. Good for him. He'd worked hard to rid himself of some poor habits, and deserved every penny. Antonio was next, going to the Wizards. Just like that, 2 of our core were gone, and you can't afford to lose any of your core if you hope to compete for a championship. You can tinker with it, adding a piece here, a piece there, to build around the other guys, but you can't lose it. In addition to Jerome and Anthony, we lost somebody else important that summer. We lost Nate McMillan. Paul Allen, the owner of the Portland Trailblazers, made Nate an offer he couldn't turn down. Nate and I weren't tight. I'm not sure he was close to any player, really, but he had done a very good job. As for my own future, I chose to stay put, agreeing to a 5-year extension for $80 million, with another $5 million in incentives. Other teams showed interest, the Hawks and the Clippers being the most persistent, but Shannon and I, along with our first child, Ray Ray, had found a home in Seattle. We loved the city and the people, and could think of no better place to raise our family. This franchise had enjoyed some memorable moments. A title in the 1970s, a trip to the finals in the 1990s, and I won the fans over just as I did in Milwaukee. I could easily imagine spending the rest of my career there. Rick Sund, the GM, thought 5 years was too many to offer someone at my ripe old age of 30. He presented me with a chart of statistics to prove the average player, once he turns 33 or 34, isn't nearly as productive. Maybe, but I wasn't the average player. I truly appreciate and respect where you are coming from, I told Rick, but you know my habits. You know I'm not a drinker, and I don't stay out late. So you should know I'm going to be around a lot longer than a lot of those other guys you mentioned. He never showed me any statistics again, and I got the 5th year. Turning 30, as I did that same month, is usually a time to take stock of one's career, and I was no exception. So what if I hadn't won a championship? Coach Calhoun was right. You need some luck. Luck I was still waiting for. 1 year, I went through the entire roster of the team that won the title. I must admit I was jealous. You kidding me? That guy got a ring too? But the more I thought about it, the more I realized it would be no shame if I never earned one. It doesn't take anything away from the greatness of Karl Malone or Charles Barkley or John Stockton or Patrick Ewing or other Hall of Famers who didn't win a championship. Besides, there was still time. 11. Please come to Boston. Bob Weiss, one of our assistant coaches, took over for Nate. His calm approach was what our younger players needed. The last thing you ever want is your coach to yell at you as Chris Ford did. Believe me, when you screw up, you're the first to know. That's why I stopped looking over at the bench after I threw a bad pass or let my man score an easy bucket. Coach, if you're not helping me, you're hurting me. As the 2005-06 season wore on, however, and our mistakes piled up, Bob was too calm. Whenever we lost a game, he would say softly, "That's okay, guys. We'll figure it out tomorrow." That's fine every so often, but most times we needed a kick in the ass. Only that wasn't Bob's personality. That was George's, which is why you search for a coach who can be soothing or severe, depending on the situation. Doc Rivers was like that. So was Jim Calhoun. Meanwhile, ownership wasn't willing to wait for tomorrow. In early January, after just 30 games, we were 13-17. They let Bob go. And I thought Chris, who was fired after 2 seasons, hadn't been given enough time, though I got the feeling Bob was ready to go, that he believed he'd done everything he could. Either way, I blamed myself. Whenever a coach is fired, it's on the players. If we do our job, he keeps his. As with Chris, I never got a chance to say goodbye to Bob. That's the way it goes in the NBA. They fire you, and you are out of town before sunset. The team was in Chicago, I believe, when Bob Hill, one of our assistant coaches, replaced Weiss and addressed us for the first time. Dressed us down was more like it. Motherfucker this, motherfucker that. You'd think we had gone 0-30 by how disgusted Bob was. "We have a shoot-around tomorrow," he said, "and it is going to be one of the hardest shoot-arounds you've ever had." I felt as if I were back in freshman year at UConn, going through drill after drill. We never practiced that hard under Coach Weiss or Nate for that matter. Mind you, I'm not complaining. We needed the work. Bob was hard on me on occasion, but he didn't yell at me like Chris did. He actually went out of